So welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us this evening for our seminar, Will's Getting It Right, But What If It Goes Wrong? I'm so pleased that so many of you could join us online today. We've had a really good turnout. Due to demand, we've turned this from an in-person event to online, simply to allow more people to come. And we've got people from all over the country joining us. So that's fantastic. So I'll just explain a little bit about who we've got here today speaking. So firstly, you're going to hear from me. My name is Emma Saunders. I'm a partner and head of contentious probate at Sintoms. And I'm going to be doing a bit of a double header along with my colleague, Jonathan Grogan, who's also a contentious probate specialist, but he's also spent quite a lot of time in non-contentious probate practice. And so he's been at the sort of coalface of will drafting, so to speak. He's a full step member, and so his input should be invaluable. Sintoms, our team here, are band one ranked in Chambers High Net Worth for private wealth disputes in the Northeast and Yorkshire, just so you know who we are. And we're delighted that we're joined today by Catherine McQuayle, who is a barrister at Radcliffe Chambers. She's highly experienced and she's a leading junior barrister for private client matters, including trusts, probate and court protection disputes. Catherine also deals with professional negligence arising out of these areas, along with property and partnership cases. Catherine also sits as a deputy master in the Chancery Division, and so she's very well versed in addressing areas that arise within will drafting. So, in terms of the aim of today's seminar, firstly, we're going to examine the main areas of challenges to wills that are drafted by solicitors. We're going to look at how testators' wishes can be protected with regards to those areas of challenge and in relation to sort of general best practice. And we're going to consider how firms can seek to reduce the hassle of dealing with disputed wills. And then Catherine's going to focus more on what to do when drafting perhaps goes a little wrong. So in relation to White and Jones and professional negligence, and also we'll touch on construction and rectification. So we're aiming to be speaking probably for about an hour and a quarter altogether. So thank you again for joining us. So these are in terms of the fourth, probably most common types of challenges to wills, which arise that are in relation to those drafted by solicitors. There are others such as fraud and forgery, but they are more commonly alleged in relation to homemade wills. So we're not going to touch too much on that today. So we've got testamentary capacity, knowledge and approval, undue influence and due execution, which relate to the validity of a will. And then the second part of the presentation by me and Jonathan will be looking at challenges that relate to the terms of the will itself rather than to the validity of the document. So quite frankly, much of the content today is probably likely to be a refresher of good practice. I think it's important to remember that many will disputes don't arise for many years after the will's been prepared. So following best practice at the time of making the will can make your life a lot easier if you're then having to reflect upon that many years into the future. So that's the introduction. I'm just going to pass on to Jonathan, who's going to touch on testamentary capacity.
Hello. Yes, we're looking at testamentary capacity. This is a bit of a whistle stop, a reminder about the issues that we face here. We know that for a will to be valid, a testator should be of sound mind, memory and understanding. And where a will looks rational on the face of it, a court will presume capacity. It will be for somebody who wants to challenge the will, to the burden will then shift onto them to actually prove that the testator lacked capacity. And in most cases, that person will be referred to the test set out in Banks and Goodfellow, which is an 1870 case. So that's the common law test, and it's set out there on the slide. There are sort of four limbs to it, really. Firstly, the testator needs to be able to understand that they're making a will and it'll have the effects of carrying out their wishes on death. Secondly, the testator needs to be aware, capable of knowing the extent of their property and what it consists of. And thirdly, they must be able to recall those that have a moral claim on them. And so they have to understand that those claims can be both included and excluded as beneficiaries from the will. The fourth limb, which really relates to that third one, is that the person should have no disorder of the mind that should poison their affections or pervert their sense of right. So that's the common law test, which has been well known. Since the introduction of the Mental Capacity Act in 2005, there's been quite a lot of judicial debate as to whether the Banks and Goodfellow test has been displaced or modified. There are very often the two will produce the same result. I think it's generally considered that the statutory test is perhaps a higher test, a more difficult one to show that the person had capacity. It does seem eventually that the matter has been settled, at least for the time being. And then in the 2022 case this year, Clitheroe and Bonds, the court was very firmly of the view that it is the Banks and Goodfellow test that should prevail. The test is always issue specific. So if you have a less complicated estate with fewer beneficiaries, then the level of capacity for that kind of a will might be less than if it was a much more complicated will. And we've seen developments over recent years in the law sort of catching up with developments in psychiatry. The law now recognises that there are disorders of the mind such as clinical depression, which can have an effect on the ability to, on testamentary capacity. In the Key and Key case of 2010 was a major development in that line of thinking. So I'm just going to look at some practical guidance now on what we actually do, practitioners, when considering mental capacity to make a will. And this slide is headed with the Golden Rule. You'd be familiar with the Golden Rule. It came out of a case in 1975, Kenwood and Adams, and it stated there, Templeman, Mr. Justice Templeman, as he was then, said that in the case of an aged testator or a testator who has suffered a serious illness, the Golden Rule should always be observed, however straightforward matters, however tactless it might be, and that is that the maker of the will should have their will witnessed or approved by a medical practitioner. I think some practitioners think that the Golden Rule is almost like a rule of law, that it has to be applied and that will determine whether the will is valid or not. And it's not a rule of law. It's a guidance, it's judicial guidance as to best practice. And there I've said judicial sympathy. In some cases, the court's quite sympathetic to practitioners who have not followed the Golden Rule. In Wharton and Bancroft, the criticism of the experienced solicitor that had taken the will instructions and had considered that the person was capacitous, that criticism was misplaced, the judge said. And in Hawes and Burgess 2013 case, the Lord Justice Mumry went as far as saying that where a will was prepared by an experienced and independent solicitor following a meeting where the solicitor had recorded in an attendance note, that the testator had capacity, that the will should only be set aside on the clearest evidence of lack of mental capacity. So some judicial encouragement there for the situations we often find ourselves in, where it's not possible always to follow the Golden Rule. But there is criticism where people don't follow the Golden Rule. There are other cases which we can point to. Key and Key, for example, which I've already mentioned. There, the judge was highly critical of the solicitor, commenting that he had greatly increased the difficulties giving rise to the dispute by not following the Golden Rule. And as Catherine will touch upon, all of this can lead to claims against the solicitors in due course. So that's what we have to be very careful. I also mentioned there that this year we've had the case of Boast and Ballardi, and there the solicitor does seem to have gone rather AWOL. He spoke to a GP who told him that the testator didn't have capacity, but then the solicitor went back to the client and the client seems to have persuaded the solicitor, gave him assurances that he did have capacity, and the solicitor was influenced by that and went ahead and made the will, and the solicitor was criticised later. So some cases you are best following the Golden Rule. I do mention there quickly the case of Feldman Buscale. That's a bit of a nightmare case where somebody took will instructions, delayed instructing, they did instruct a GP, delayed over that. The GP eventually provided their report. The solicitor then seems to have formed his own view that the testator perhaps didn't want to change her will after all, so sort of sat on things. The family got fed up and made their own will, a homemade will for the testator. That was declared invalid, and the solicitor ended up, I think, being liable for the beneficiary's losses for not getting on with preparing the will once he got the medical report. Some practical advice. I think basically the law recognises and guidance such as STEPS code, and also this very useful Law Society Wills and Inheritance Protocol, which I have seen referred to in some cases recently, even for firms that haven't adopted the Wills and Inheritance Quality Scheme. It's worth a read because it does touch on issues like this, and it recognises this sort of between the rock and a hard place situation that solicitors can find themselves in over this kind of issue. We can be a bit embarrassed about suggesting needs to obtain medical reports to clients. Can be a bit delicate sometimes, but normally if you explain the importance of ensuring the will is valid and free from attack after they died, the clients normally do appreciate that obtaining a medical opinion might be helpful. If we are instructing a medical expert, who do we go to? Is it the GP? And that might be the best port of call. That practice, some practices don't offer this kind of service. They won't provide reports, but if they know the the client, they're often the best people to approach. But we might also have to think about going to someone more specialist, maybe a psychogeriatrician in certain cases. There are precedents that will help you in pairing letters of instruction. Don't assume that the medics will know about Banks and Goodfellow. So look to guidance, which is practical, or they have a precedent letter, very useful. And whatever we do, whether we decide to go ahead, make a capacity assessment ourselves, or we decide to advise the clients that they need a report, document it. I think the message of today is do a good attendance note. If you are assessing capacity yourself, try and follow those limbs in Banks and Goodfellow. Maybe have for your department, have a precedent, a template which actually has it there as a prompt for you to look at. And also the fuller the attendance note, the better. It gives some wider pictures to how the person appeared that day. Did they engage with pleasantries? How did they get to the office? The fuller the picture, the better. So I think that's hopefully helpful for you. I'm just going to pass on to Compass knowledge and approval, which Emma's going to cover.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Duncan. So another ground of challenge to validity of a will may be the testator's knowledge and approval. And clearly they need to know and approve the contents of their will. It's often raised at the same time as testamentary capacity. It's a bit of a dual attack. Now, if a beneficiary has been involved in the preparation or execution of a will, then the suspicion of the court may well be excited and affirmative proof of knowledge and approval is needed. I think Jonathan will touch on briefly when he discusses undue influence about trying to keep beneficiaries away from the will-making process. Now, there is a presumption of knowledge and approval if the testator had testamentary capacity and the will was duly executed. Well, as I say, often testamentary capacity is attacked at the same time. But I would say don't get too complacent if you think those two areas have been covered off, particularly if your instructions for a will have changed over time. We often see very good attendance notes for initial will instructions, much less of a paper trail when it comes to whatever changes have been made. And it's important to make sure that it's clear that the will that is finally executed is indeed one that the testator knows and approves of. There's also a presumption of knowledge and approval if the will is read over at execution as per Gill and Woodall, but make sure that you do go over the contents of the will with your client if you meet with them to execute the will, which, you know, in an ideal scenario you would do, or ensure if you're not meeting with them that they do have the details of the will explained to them in written form, and also trying to make that fairly simple and tailor that to each client. It's obviously very tempting to use some pro formas, which can be very helpful, but make sure, if particularly if depending on sort of the individual client, that it's suitable for their needs. Now, if you are particularly concerned about this will being challenged in the future, so if the client is doing something that could be considered controversial, you may want to take a little bit more care about demonstrating this on your will file. So I would say, in terms of explaining provisions, don't simply read over the will. Set out what each clause does. So, for example, what the residuary estate means. I think I find a lot of time talking to clients, and if you talk about residue or residuary estate, they have quite simply no idea what you're talking about. So I think you just need to sort of put forward in layman's terms. You may want to think about probing the client's understanding of the will as well. So about what the contents and effect are in a meeting with them prior to execution of the document, if possible. And by doing this, you might want to think about asking non-leading questions to confirm the understanding. So rather than telling them they're leaving a legacy of £10,000 to two different nieces, perhaps ask them, did they want to leave any legacies of cash? And if so, who to? And obviously, if you're getting the answer that is the same as the document that you've got in front of you, then that is incredibly helpful. One other tip that I would give, and this is important to record that you do this as well if you're going to do it, is to encourage some sort of positive input from the testator. I think sometimes when it gets to the point where we're receiving a statement, perhaps from a will drafting solicitor about how the meeting went, we'll often see things like, well, the client sort of nodded or said yes to things. So I thought, you know, I understood them to know what I was talking about and to approve their will. Now, that may well be the case, but also we may have a client coming in to us saying, oh, but yes, but granddad was incredibly deaf, and or he was suffering from dementia, and he would always nod in a meeting with somebody because he was always, you know, trying to portray that he understood what was going on and or that he could hear them. So those are sort of things. If you encourage positive input so that your client actually has to respond to something you're saying, then that should give you greater confidence. But again, record that. So if you're going to do that, record that in a note. Making sure you go through any will with a client in manageable chunks. Again, as Jonathan said, it depends on the will. If this is straightforward will, should be a bit easier. But if it's a complex one, then you'll think, you know, you need to think carefully about how you're explaining some of the more complex provisions in the will to your client. Now, as we know, usually will challenges come about because someone's been excluded and they think that's unfair. Now, this, if someone is going to be excluded, hopefully that's already come up at your will instructions initial meeting. But there's no harm in asking them about this again. Record anything they're saying in their own words. This simply reinforces their wishes. And so if you've got two attendance notes saying exactly the same thing about the person they want to exclude and giving reasons for it, then again, that should help if there is a future challenge to the will. We keep talking about attendance notes, but sadly they are the answer to a lot of the issues that arise. So if you keep a very good attendance note of any meeting, you're going through the will with the client, and what your client has said about anything or about anybody that's in there, if that's relevant. If you're not asking someone to type that note up, then do make sure it's legible. There's nothing worse than sort of a will file sort of appearing 10 years later and the person who's written the note is, can't really translate it for either for themselves or for anyone else. So do make sure the attendance notes are legible. If you can't meet with the client, then obviously best practice would be to send out some explanatory notes or a letter to the client sending, you know, explaining what the will does. This is obviously especially important if your client is going to execute the will elsewhere. And again, just evidence that this has happened, make sure that you are keeping a copy of that correspondence on your will file and store it securely. Make sure that it's staying in your file. One thing that's come up more recently, I think one sort of outcome of the pandemic and potential sort of remote witnessing of wills, is recording will instruction meetings or will execution meetings. If there is a high risk of challenge, you might want to think about doing this. Obviously, your client will need to consent and you'll need to store any recording again very securely. But again, it's something that if there is a high risk of challenge and you could have very strong, powerful video evidence from the testator, which wouldn't necessarily be seen until after their death, but could prove very valuable in defending any challenge to the will. So as I say, these are all sort of issues that will vary depending on the client and the situation that they're in. But do think about it, do think about each individual client and how complex their will is and how simple it may be, and indeed whether they're seeking to do something controversial. So and now I'm just going to pass back to Jonathan, who's going to talk to us a little bit about undue influence.
Yes, undue influence. What does that look like? And it might be said often it's the hardest challenge to bring in relation to disputing a will, because what we're talking about here is where the will has actually been made as a result of coercion. So this is not just influence and persuasion, which can be legitimate, but this goes much further, and the testator has lost their agent, their free agency. They've been forced into doing something. It doesn't involve violence necessarily. Few cases have a sort of gun to the head, but what we often see is a build-up of evidence which suggests that the person's mind was overborne really by pressure of one sort or another. So we have to bear in mind that the older and weaker in body or mind, or in body and mind, that the person is, then the easier they are to influence. So we have to bear that in mind when we see clients as to their vulnerability to be influenced. We might think that most cases of undue influence are more likely to happen where the family have perhaps made there's a homemade will that the influencer has managed to get the testator to sign. And that indeed, that might well be the case. But there are cases, and I've just put two cases there, they're both in 2013, Schomburg and Taylor and Schrader and Schrader, which just show that a professional will drafter can be involved where there is undue influence. In both those cases, the wills were set aside. In Schomburg, the influence was very much behind the scenes. The solicitor drafted the will, didn't raise any concerns, kept detailed attendance note, but maybe there were some warning signs. For instance, the influencer, who was a Mr. Perkin, who was going to be the beneficiary, he sort of parachuted in someone who was going to be the executor, and Mr. Randall. Turns out that he was a retired solicitor who had acted for Mr. Perkin, and maybe the solicitor might have thought, well, who's this person? Why are they getting involved? So we've got to just look for red flags. Why are new solicitors being instructed? Why is there such a departure from previous wills? And in Schrader, similarly, there was influence going on. And The solicitor again took detailed attendance notes, but the judge did sort of criticise the will drafter because I think she relied on pro forma attendance notes, which can be good practice. We touched upon that. Good, can be good aid memoirs. But the judge said there was a lack of breadth in the way that she had sought the instructions, perhaps an over-reliance on pro formas, and she hadn't discussed previous wills and why it was such a departure from previous wills. So practical steps for helping to avoid undue influence. I think it's difficult. I don't think we're expected to sort of police undue influence where it can't be detected. You know, we can't be sort of looking for things that aren't there that we can't see. But maybe, you know, if instructions come in by email, rather, you know, who sent the email, particularly if we have sort of suspicions about the origins of instructions, always try and see clients on their own in person, preferably, obviously, we know the benefits of that. And as I said earlier, the more frail and maybe anxious that the client is, then perhaps we have to sort of be conscious about their vulnerability to being influenced. Does the explanation they give for a radical departure from a previous will, does that seem plausible? Does it really reflect the testator's actual intentions? I'm going to hand over to Emma, who's going to talk about challenges based on due execution.
Thank you. So, yes, you do have a duty to check the execution of wills that are received by you, whether you're asked to or not. So that's an important thing to remember. In terms of trying to avoid situations arising, of course, the best case scenario is again to be with the client to supervise the execution if at all possible. And again, keep a note of that meeting if you can. It may be the same meeting that I was talking about earlier in relation to demonstrating knowledge and approval, but rather than there just be an executor will arrive on a file, if you've got a note which simply says who came in, who was there, who was present, it doesn't need to be a long note. But then it does demonstrate that it's been done correctly and where it's been done. Keep a note on the file, even like I say, even if that meeting is brief. You know, for example, one of the questions that often comes up in relation to undue influence challenges is that one child perhaps who benefits more greatly under the will has been the driving force behind the will. And we all know full well that a lot of testators will have one child that spends a lot more time caring for their parent. And that may well be why they genuinely want to benefit them. But if a child's coming in to drop their mum or dad off for a will execution, then you know, make sure that they're kept outside of the meeting, but also record that they may have brought their mum in, but that they did indeed sit outside. And it's just really helpful to have that recorded. It might be your best practice, but best to kind of keep a note that it actually did happen. If you're receiving executed wills that the clients have done at home and you're receiving those by post or been dropped into the office, then do check them carefully and make sure that's done by a will solicitor, someone who's experienced with wills and not an administrator or a secretary. It's easy to sort of push down these tasks and just assume it's just general post, but really it is very important, obviously, to check that this has been done properly. Even if you've sent quite detailed advice about how to execute a will and how a beneficiary shouldn't be signing, you know full well that it does happen. So just to keep an eye out for that. I've recently seen a will file where the first will that which the client intended to make came back witness but not signed. Now the solicitor did pick up on that, but if that hadn't been noticed, that would have been slightly disastrous for all involved. So do keep your eyes peeled. And if a client has received their will but not executed it, and we all know that there are clients that come in, have their will drafted and don't get around to making them, then do remind them, chase them if they don't respond in writing. Set out how their estate is going to pass, whether that be by the previous will or an intestacy. Just remind them precisely what will happen if this will isn't made. And again, obviously keep all that correspondence on file. So if there's any criticism of you not having followed up with your client, you can say, well, actually I did on this date and this date. You obviously can't do it forever, but a couple of chases seems certainly reasonable. And, you know, if there is a lack of engagement, then write to your client and make very clear that you need to close the file, and often sending an invoice is enough to wake the client up sometimes, isn't it? So I think those are things you sort of need to just think about in relation to your execution. And I'm going to pass back to Jonathan again.
Yeah, we're just going to pause at this point and just sort of make some comments about general file keeping that might be helpful in a mitigating against will challenges. So we have obviously the hub mantra today, which is keeping clear attendance notes. We've talked about the pros and cons of using pro formas. one of the good things, obviously, is to have consistency, if you're in a team, to have consistency in your approach. And it may be that introducing proformas might be useful. I mentioned again the Law Society Wills and Inheritance Protocol, worth a read. It talks about file keeping, things which obviously if you're going to join the Law Society scheme, they would expect you to do, and it's good practice, it's helpful stuff to read that. Consider the use of a will questionnaire. Again, they have their pros and cons. I've seen them where the clients haven't understood necessarily the questions in the questionnaire, or on further probing, there's a lot more to it. So keep them with a bit of a health warning perhaps, but they have their place. Care when delegating drafting, and we all know that goes on, and for good reason. Perhaps more senior solicitors will delegate the task of drafting to a more junior colleague, and what we don't want to happen there is obviously things getting lost in translation, and the better the attendance note that accompanies the memo or the email asking drafting to be done, that will help that junior colleague or whoever it is. But that is an element of risk, obviously, within a firm. Don't delay in drafting. Unhelpfully, perhaps not surprisingly, the law doesn't give you a great deal of guidance as to how long we should leave drafting a will. It's perhaps specific. If we have an elderly testator who we think might be close to death, then it's obviously going to be more urgent. Build into our client care letters how long it'll take us to draft the letter, so there's an expectation there. And obviously it's hard to say how long it should be left, but I think experienced practitioners, we know what is reasonable in terms of how long it should be left, and we don't really want to fall outside those kind of timescales. Checking title to joint property, a big area of risk where clients want to do something with their property they have their respective shares passing to maybe a life interest trust on the first death. Do they actually own the property as joint tenants, or are they already tenants in property? So check the title. There's been a case this year, Dunbabin, which suggests, well, the judge held that actually, although the tenancy hadn't been severed, it was severed, but it hadn't been severed by notice, or it wasn't clear that in fact the execution of the mirror wills, which put life interest trusts into place, constituted an agreement and conduct to sever the tenancy. So that's come to the help maybe of firms that hadn't severed the tenancy, but let's not rely on cases or having to go to court to clarify the situation, but deal with the severance of the tenancy if that's required as part of the will planning. Marriage, ask, obviously, if you've got a client who mentions they're in a relationship, are they going to get married? Is the prospect, is that likely? Do they know that their will be revoked by marriage otherwise, or do they want to actually for the will to survive any prospective marriage and make that clear in the will? And then we mentioned foreign assets, big area to sort of where people can trip up. Are there foreign assets? Do you have a foreign will? Are we dealing with all your worldwide estate, or are we dealing just with your English and Welsh assets? Have you got a will? We don't want to revoke a will by revoking putting a revocation clause in this English will. Questions to be answered. Just be obviously even to be careful about these issues. And now Emma's going to talk to us about Larkin Nugas requests.
Okay, so Larkin Nugas requests, I think it's probably sort of thing that lands in your post tray and makes people's heart sink, or probably their email inbox more than these days, as will drafters. And I'm one of the solicitors that send these things out. So I apologise in advance if you get one from me. I know how annoying they are to deal with. So just to give you an update, the Law Society practice note on disputed wills has just recently been updated in July. So if you do receive a Larkin Nugas request, it's probably worth having just another look at that to refresh your memory. It also has incorporated some new guidance in relation to issues arising from GDPR, so it's worth having a look. So for those of you who are will drafters who are lucky enough not to know what a Larkin Nugas request is, it's a request for information about the preparation and execution of a will. It's sent in the initial stages of a will dispute. And in many cases, a dispute does not continue past this initial request for information, but it is an important part of the will dispute process. You may be asked to make a Larkin Nugas statement as the executor and or will drafter. You have a duty, as per the case of Larkin Nugas, to make every effort to avoid potentially costly litigation. The solicitor in Larkin Nugas was heavily criticised for failing to do so. So make sure you have the appropriate consent from the correct party or parties with regards to confidentiality and legal advice privilege prior to any disclosure of documentation on your file. Obviously, that is a really important issue. The practice note, I think, has been updated quite a lot in relation to this area, so I'm not going to go over it here. If you do have that and it becomes an issue, do certainly look at the practice note for some further guidance. So if a matter becomes, right, if it's a will dispute proceeds and it ends up at issue court proceedings, you're likely to be asked to give a formal statement. You may even need to attend court and give evidence at the trial. It's obviously a daunting prospect for anyone, frankly. So, and also you want to think about not having your name recorded on a court judgment as a solicitor who ended up giving fairly poor evidence of their practice, such as the recent case of Boaston and Bilardi, which Jonathan's just touched on, but also there was a recent case of Eat and Hog, which is actually, I think, a rectification claim from 2021. But the solicitor's evidence was said to be evasive, equivocal and frankly unsatisfactory. And no one wants a judge to say something like that about them. So I think the important thing is to try and deal with the Marcus request. One important point to note is that you can charge for your reasonable costs of compiling a statement. That's something you'll have to liaise with the person who's requesting that statement, any kind of course charged for reasonable copying charges, albeit these days with the use of email, it's unlikely that you'll even need to copy anything at all, just be scanned. So have we reduced the hassle of dealing with these dark and nervous requests? Obviously, they are really frustrating and annoying to deal with, and I suspect they do end up at the bottom of a to-do pile for a busy will drafting solicitor who's probably thinking they've got much better things to be doing. But do try to respond in a reasonable time frame. Don't put it off. And my experience of dealing with the other side of it from people who are waiting for a response is that the longer the response takes to arrive, the greater the suspicions become. And whether that's justified or not, it is quite frankly what will happen and could just escalate a dispute unnecessarily. So usually a Larkin Nugis request will use very standard questions. How long? How did you know the testator? How long did you know the testator? When did you take instructions from this will? You know, where did they come by correspondence? Please provide a copy. Did you have a meeting? Please provide a copy of the attendance note. So there's very, very, very sort of standard questions. And if you've seen more than one Larkin Nugis request, you will see that they may be tailored to each individual case, but they are very much fairly standard and follow a bit of a pattern. So if you've got the consent to disclose the information, then you certainly should do. And certainly for will challenge, if you have got one of these files that you know full well is likely to become disputed after your client's death, then you should probably make sure that all Larkin Nugis questions are addressed on the file at the time of making the will. I've heard of people actually preparing almost a Larkin Nugis statement at the time that the testator is making the will and is still alive in order to deal with this. That does seem like quite a lot of work for the average file, but we all know that you'll have the odd one that might see a very, very good use of your time for. In relation to what questions might come up and what you might want to do, I would suggest that you keep copies of the executed wills on files, but also any drafts. So having looked at various will files over the years, I would say that saving a draft will as a separate file or a separate version, depending on your software, is very helpful, rather than simply saving over the document with any changes made. Because what can happen is it can make a paper trail very difficult to follow. And if there isn't sort of a clear note, the client's called up and said they want to make a change, if there isn't a note of that call, and then suddenly the executed will is a little bit different from the initial instructions, and that's the only documents that are on file, then it really does sort of inflame matters, raise suspicions, and can make your life difficult, because, you know, if this happens 5 years later, you're unlikely to remember precisely what happened. With regards to keeping files, the Law Society guidance on file retention for wills is that you should err on the side of caution with regards to storing wills, even if you believe a later will has been made, quite frankly, because they know that doesn't necessarily mean that it would be a valid one. So the Law Society guidance says that even if the will is revoked, a copy should be kept in your records. So that's just a bit of a reminder to try and keep these things safe. And we talked earlier, I think Jonathan mentioned about people using other firms. So if your client has used another firm previously for their wills, they may have a perfectly valid reason for changing firms, but obtaining a copy of the will file with your client's consent, obviously, from previous solicitors will allow you to consider whether there's been any dramatic changes and therefore potentially contentious changes to those wills. And then you can discuss them with your client and address that as necessary. What I would say is don't get upset or offended if you get a Larka Nurgis request. Please try not to take it personally. It's not a personal criticism. This is really especially important if you're an executor, as you need to remain neutral to any will dispute, and you could be criticised if you don't. And also I would say that sometimes we get quite stroppy or grumpy replies to our Larka Nurgis requests. And I do understand the reasons for it, but do remember that anything that you do write may end up in front of a judge or in a trial bundle. So you just want to think about that. So that's really looking at challenges to wills. And now we're just going to focus a little bit on disputes that relate to the terms within a will. So firstly, Jonathan's going to look at proprietary estoppel, and then I'm going to turn advocate to the inheritance.
Thanks, Emma. So proprietary estoppel, that might be something which as will drafters we think we don't really have to worry about. That's something that maybe our litigation colleagues are more interested in. But it can be something for us to bear in mind when drafting wills. Just a quick reminder, the doctrine of proprietary estoppel, if it's successful, if the claim's successful, then the will, whatever's in the will, and whoever is appointed executors of that will, they may be held to actually hold something on trust for the person who claims a proprietary estoppel claim, an equity has arisen in their favour. So there's been suggested in an earlier case law that a promise to be left somebody's estate, residuary estate, say, couldn't be subject to a claim of proprietary estoppel, but even a promise to be left somebody's estate, that can be subject to a claim. And that was in Gillett and Holt that was clarified. Basically, the elements that quickly there, you have to have promise, there has to be some kind of assurance by the representor that this person would be given something. That person then has to rely on that promise, and not just rely, but rely to their detriment in some way. And then the fourth limb there, which is really, it's been described as the sort of raison d'etre of the doctrine, there has to be unconscionability. So the whole thing has to seem unfair for it to be undone. So the person who made the representation, it would be unconscionable for them to go back on the promise that they had made. So where do we see that happening? Well, most of the cases, as people probably know, have been about farms, and there's been a bumper crop of those cases in recent years. Why that is, maybe there's a willingness to encourage younger generations to commit to the venture of farming whilst harbouring maybe a corresponding reluctance to formalise such arrangements. And so that's why we've seen maybe a lot of farming cases, but also think about other family businesses, family partnerships. Look at situations where maybe the testator is thinking of leaving the whole of their interest in the business to be shared amongst their children. But is the one child maybe that has been more instrumental in running the business? Maybe a discussion can be had about where does that person stand? Do they feel maybe that they're entitled? Has a promise been made to them? I'm not suggesting that's something that we should probe in every will interview, but there might be some situations where it may be appropriate, or the client says something which then leads to a discussion. We suggest this is probably a counsel of perfection, and I must admit, I've not done this myself. I've not had cause to do this myself. There might be a situation where if the testator appears to be going back on something which somebody might be expecting to receive, then discuss that with them. Do you want to make a statement, just like a sort of 1975 Act statement that accompanies the will? Should a statement be made to explain why the person who thinks they might be getting the business or the farm, they're not being left it, or not being left it entirely? And there might be some reasons for that. The promise, there was change in circumstances, the person didn't carry out their side of the bargain. So just we're putting that out there as something to perhaps think about in taking your instructions in those sort of situations, whether that might be something to consider. And then the other area where there might be claims about how the estate should be distributed without necessarily challenging the validity of the will, are Inheritance Act claims, and then we'll talk about that.
Okay, so Inheritance Act claims, I'm sure something that a lot of you will be thinking about if you're drafting a will for a client and they're thinking about excluding somebody. So I'll just do a little bit of a refresher. So they are a claim for reasonable financial provision. That could be because somebody's been excluded from a will entirely, or it could be because they've been included as a beneficiary but they don't consider that it's sort of sufficient. The categories of claimant are a spouse or civil partner sometimes, but quite rarely it could be a former spouse or civil partner. could be a cohabiting partner, and they're quite common claimants, and also then a child or a person who's treated as a child of the family, or it could be somebody maintained. So there's quite a broad range of people that do potentially have a claim on somebody's estate under the terms of the Act. So the claim is for reasonable financial provision, as I said. It's for the claimant's maintenance, unless they're a spouse or civil partner, then it's what would be reasonable in all the circumstances, whether or not for their maintenance. So that's just sort of a broad brush, but I know that it is something that you'll be thinking about. So if someone's excluding somebody, they may have perfectly valid reasons for doing so. What can you do to try and support that client or their estate post their death, when this is going to come to a head? One thing you could consider is making a statement of reasons for the person's exclusion. But I would say these do very much need to be a factual statement and not emotional. And that can be very difficult for your client to be able to put together. You might want to explain why the client thinks that some people would be more deserving or needy than others. But I say make sure that any statement is very much up to date, because circumstances can change. And also, you might want to consider with your client that such statements can very often be a double-edged sword. They may inflame matters post-death, depending on what's being put in that statement. So you really need to think carefully about whether it's going to help. You also might want to encourage your client to keep details of any lifetime provision they've made. For example, if it was an adult child, and one of the reasons that they are kind of either reducing that child's entitlement or excluding them is because they've had so much during their lifetime, then you do need to ask your client to keep a record of that lifetime provision and also keep that up to date. So it just doesn't need to be at the time of making the will, it needs to be constant. So they may want to just keep that at home, maybe on an Excel spreadsheet, maybe in a little notebook that they keep with their private documents. But you do need to encourage them to kind of keep that very much up to date. Now, other things that your client might think about could be to make some provision for the person they're intending to exclude. They might do this quite reluctantly, but sometimes a small legacy might be enough to deter somebody. They might think they'd rather take that rather than risk the stress and the costs of sort of litigation over the estate. And we all know it's very difficult sometimes to know how a judge will view a claim and what the value they might put on it. Now, also some provision to the next generation down might also deter. So if somebody's seeking to exclude a child, I keep picking on them, but it's often a child that gets excluded. They may, if that child has their own children, want to leave a gift to the grandchildren. This may sort of placate the parent in it's kind of staying on their bit side of the family, maybe, but it would also perhaps deter them on the basis that it would make their own children defendants to any claim they chose to bring as beneficiaries of the estate. So it's something that, again, you might want to consider with your clients. Another option could be the use of a forfeiture clause or a no contest clause. These are designed to prevent a challenge, because the person they choose to challenge the will would be losing the gift in the will if they did so. It may be simply enough to deter somebody for the risk of losing the benefit that they're intending that they would receive if they didn't challenge the gift. But in relation to Inheritance Act claims, there is some scope for arguing that such a claim isn't a challenge to the will, because you're not challenging the validity of the document. But again, that's a potentially quite risky argument. The wording of any clause needs to be thought through carefully. It's key. Sometimes they can be determined they're void for uncertainty. If they're imprecise, that's something that needs to be thought about. And they must also contain a gift over in the clause, so a clear intention to benefit somebody else on the forfeiture of the gift by the person complaining. So those are things to think about. There's not too much case law that I've come across against forfeiture clauses in wills. I mean, there's Nathan and Leonard, but that is from 2002. That does say that such clauses aren't contrary to public policy, but it also highlights that if there is an Inheritance Act claim made, then the court will obviously have to take that into account when considering what reasonable financial provision looks like. So if someone's potentially losing a gift, then that will be quantified in as part of the claim. So again, not necessarily a straightforward solution to the issues. One other option you might want to consider with your clients is placing assets in a discretionary trust, which includes any potential claimant as a beneficiary. Again, this might deter potentially some claimants, but again, it's not a perfect solution. If there's no certainty of distribution, then it could be considered a lack of reasonable financial provision. And I indeed sort of brought claims, inheritance claims, on the basis that somebody was only a discretionary trust beneficiary. But obviously, if the trustees then choose to distribute a sum to the claimant, they may be satisfied and not pursue the claim. So there is some flexibility for sort of resolving matters perhaps quite easily post-death. So really, I think in conclusion, sort of touching on what me and Jonathan have been speaking about, there's only so much you can do. We're very conscious that will drafting is not an easy, it's not an easy job. You can only sort of advise your clients. You can't force them to get a capacity report, even if you think it's a good idea. Is you can only guide them as to what would be best and put that guidance, that record that you've given that guidance on your file. It's impossible to prevent every single claim. All you can do is try to reduce the likelihood of them coming. I think it's probably very clear that our view is that good file keeping is key. Certainly from our side as contentious probate practitioners, seeing a very well kept will file with good detailed attendance notes, which make very clear that a lot of these issues have been considered, say for example capacity has been considered, you know, particularly if there's a capacity report there, you know, that you know does certainly affect the advice that we would give to a client about the potential merits of any claim. So I think the important thing to remember is that you're all doing the best practice. It's a matter of just recording that you're doing it. Whether that's to protect your client or whether it's to protect your firm in the longer term, just make sure that what you're doing is being recorded. And certainly, like I say, a clear will file will reduce the hassle and the costs of responding to inquiries about wills. You need to take a proportionate approach. I really appreciate you can't do everything that we've said for every single will file. You need to take each one as it comes, but take greater precautions if there's a likelihood of dispute. And that's really the best that we can kind of suggest to you today. So I'm now going to pass on to Catherine. I'm just going to just talk to you about a different topic.
Good evening, everyone. I'm going to deal with two areas, really. What I'm going to call White and James liability, the way in which and why in which will writers may become liable to people who are not their clients, often disappointed beneficiaries. And when I refer to will writers, it's because the liability will attach not only to solicitors, but legal executives and others who act professionally in drafting wills. And then I'm going to go on to consider what can be done if it appears that something has gone wrong and how that something may reduce exposure to White and Jones type claims or claims for loss by the testator's estate. So quick run through the history of White and Jones liability. It's all about public policy, really. And I think few of us would dispute that as a matter of policy, someone who is a disappointed beneficiary because a professional person has made a mistake, there should be a liability to that person. It was said by Justice Cook in New Zealand, the case of Gartside in Sheffield in 1983, to deny an effective remedy in a plain case would seem to imply a refusal to acknowledge the solicitor's professional role in the community. In practice, the public relies on solicitors to prepare effective wills. It would be a failure of the legal system not to insist on some practical responsibility. That well encapsulates the policy rationale for the liability. The question of the liability is a particular example of the more general question of how to set the boundaries of liability in tort for pure economic loss, or in this particular situation, more usually a failure to gain, so financial damage where there's been no physical damage to either person or property. Before White and Jones was decided by the House of Lords in 1995, to succeed in tort, claimants needed to establish that an advisor who was not in a contractual relationship had assumed some sort of responsibility to the claimant, and that there had been reliance on the advice. That's the Headley, Byrne and Heller line of cases. That need for reliance seemed to exclude claims by disappointed beneficiaries against the negligent will writer. But in Ross and Caunters in 1980, Vice Chancellor McGarry held that a solicitor was liable on the basis of the authorities in tort they then stood. But as that jurisprudence developed, it was widely believed that Ross and Caunters was wrong. So in 1995, the House of Lords had the opportunity to consider a will case. The short facts was that the father had fallen out with his daughters. He made a will cutting them out. The family then made up. The testator instructed the defendant, the legal executive, to draw up a will giving his daughters, I think, £9,000 each. He died 2 months later. The will hadn't been made and the daughters were £9,000 short where they thought they should be. the will drafter lost the case in the House of Lords by a majority of 3-2. The leading speech was given by Lord Gough. What he said was, in the forefront stands the extraordinary fact that if the claimed duty is not recognised, the only person who might have a claim, that is the testator of his estate, have suffered no loss. And the only person who suffered loss, i.e. the disappointed beneficiary, has no claim. Therefore, if the solicitor owes no duty, there is a lacuna in the law which needs to be filled. So the House of Lords agreed 3-2 that the lacuna needed to be filled by extending the Hedley-Byrne principle, so that in law, the will writer's assumption of responsibility to the client gives the intended beneficiary a remedy in circumstances where it's foreseeable that the intended beneficiary would be deprived of his legacy by the negligence, and there is no remedy for the testator or his estate. The most important particular clarification of the nature of the duty was explained by Lord Justice Chadwick in the case of Cardlin and Frearson in 1999, where he pointed out that the duty owed by the solicitor to the specific legatee is not a duty to take care that the legatee receives his legacy. It's a duty to take care to ensure that effect is given to the testator's testamentary intentions. The principles derived from White and Jones and the subsequent cases can be summed up as follows: that the duty of care to the beneficiary is defined by the duty to the client. There can't be a conflict between those people or what's to be done as between them. It's the lacuna that the testator is dead and the estate has no remedy because it hasn't suffered loss, which justifies the extension of the duty. If the duty to the client is breached so as to cause loss or a failure to gain, then the beneficiary can claim for the loss. If the will is prepared without a breach of duty, there can be no claim for any loss by the prospective beneficiary. Or if the will is not prepared at all, for example, because the client testator says, no, don't worry, if you can wait until after the bank holiday weekend before you start work, I understand you're going away, solicitor, wait until Tuesday, that's fine. And the testator dies over that bank holiday weekend, there's no breach because there was a specific contractual agreement that the work wouldn't be started. There's no duty until the solicitor is retained to confer a particular benefit on the third party. The third party can't say, oh, well, he was going to instruct the solicitor. There's got to be an actual instruction, an actual retainer, as a term of which the particular benefit that is claimed to have been lost was going to be conferred. And if there's no retainer, for example, because of a lack of capacity, and that's the most obvious example, no duty of care to any intended beneficiary can arise. Thanks. The examples in the cases have mostly been referred to by Jonathan and Emma in the earlier parts of the talk. This evening's talks, the possibility of delay, failure to chase up, advice to execution, the effective disposition of joint property or trust property, issues about marriage, and the other sorts of claims that may lead to a will being overturned, certified by undue influence. And I'd add wills made in circumstances of conflict, which is one I think they hadn't mentioned. So, for example, where a husband comes to see a solicitor and say, oh, I want to cut the wife out, and the solicitor is already retained by the wife, the solicitor would be well advised not to accept those instructions because of the conflict that obviously arises. So that's another one. And just briefly, and I will only mention tax briefly because it's a subject which could occupy several evenings if one wanted it to. So tax advice is another place where several cases have considered how will writers may be liable to disappointed beneficiaries or beneficiaries who end up with an unexpected tax bill or an unexpectedly small legacy because of a tax event. If a claim is brought by a beneficiary, the burden is on the beneficiary to prove by convincing evidence that the testator intended the benefit claimed and that there was negligence. And the causation of loss must be proved. For example, if the subject of a specific legacy has been destroyed, the valuable painting went up in flames with the house some time ago, the solicitor can't be held liable for the loss of that painting that the beneficiary didn't have, because it's nothing to do with the manner of the execution or drafting of the will. And what I say there, and I can only reiterate what's already been said, that proof of both of those things is made harder by a very well-kept file recording instructions, advice, the intentions of the testator in light of the instructions and the advice, and also recording the rejection of advice. Just important to record the negative often as the positive. The claim is brought, clearly limitation, as I think it was Emma said, often these claims only come out some years later, and limitation is important to consider. The standard period for a tort claim is 6 years from the cause of action accruing. And the case of Bacon and Howard Kennedy makes clear that the cause of action in tort is complete when the damage is suffered, and that is at the date of death, when it is no longer possible to remedy things. Also important to bear in mind the 15-year long stop from the act, which amounts to the negligence, which in this case would be the drafting or the execution, and that may save claims. And it is just as a footnote, because it's rare, I think, for a beneficiary not to know within 3 years of death what has taken place, although it does sometimes happen. But the beneficiary may say, failed beneficiary, disappointed beneficiary, may say, I only knew enough to bring my claim three years from, at a point 3 years ago, and therefore I want to rely on the section 14A exception in the Limitation Act, because I've only known for the last less than the last 3 years. So what happens if there is a dispute? Consider who's complaining, when they're complaining, and what the complaint is. As to the when, the most crucial question is of when is the testator still alive or not? And also, does the testator retain capacity? If you've got a yes to both of those questions, the testator is willing to make a new will, there's no real problem. But if the apparent error is brought to your attention, not by the testator or with the testator agreeing that they're happy to make a new will, but by a person who says they're going to be the disappointed beneficiary, one must take care in relation to questions of confidentiality and privilege. Then if that complaint is made, you'd have to raise the matter with the testator, and the testator's position may well be, I never intended that beneficiary to benefit, that continues to be my intention, there was no error. And you should obviously record that position, follow it up with a confirmatory letter for the file, and point out to the testator that they may want to talk to the beneficiary about it, because the beneficiary thinks they're going to be disappointed, but you can't discuss the matter directly with the beneficiary. If the testator agrees there has been a mistake, or now wishes to change the will to benefit the complainant, the new will can be completed relatively easily. Whether or not you charge for the new will, maybe something of a judgment call, was it really a mistake or is this a change of mind? Pass that back to you to decide in a particular case. If the testator is alive but has lost capacity, it may be possible to ask the Court of Protection to make a will for the person who has lost capacity. And obviously that would follow the procedure under the Mental Capacity Act, and the court would have to make a decision whether to make a new will, and if so, what terms should be in that will in the best interests of the testator. Now, typically, the Court of Protection will be asked to make a statutory will where there would otherwise be intestacy, or where there has been significant change of circumstance since the last will. The court may also be asked to act where there's doubt about the validity of an existing will, or where a potential disappointed beneficiary might succeed in arguing that a statutory will should be made to correct an error. If an application is made, the official solicitor will generally be appointed as the testator's litigation friend, and in the testator's shoes will be able to call for the will writer's trial. If there's clear evidence of an obvious mistake, the official solicitor is likely to encourage all the parties interested to agree to a substitute will or substitute statutory will in terms that accord with correcting the mistake. But the risk that a disappointed beneficiary takes in going on this route is that other interested parties may seek to make broader representations as to the testator's best interests, either because the will is not just containing a simple error, but has other problems which might not have come out at an earlier stage. So, for example, other beneficiaries have been excluded along lines, for example, that are recorded in the note that Emma has suggested that you take about why exclusion of the child who hasn't done so much caring should be excluded. And you may end up in the Court of Protection with a very expensive and wide-ranging dispute, which doesn't simply result in a corrective error, the correction of an error, I'm sorry. Worth noting that expensive course is likely to result in the costs being ordered to be paid from the testator's estate, and beneficiaries may also incur costs that are not recoverable, and both those sets of costs may lead to a claim over against the will writer if the cause of the loss is the error that led to this dispute. If the testator has died, a number of areas that need to be considered if there appears to be an error which needs to be corrected. If all the beneficiaries affected by the error are of full age, have capacity and are agreeable, it can be fixed with a deed of variation, and that may also be, if done within 2 years, be an effective fix for tax purposes as well. And of course, the affected beneficiaries may be agreeable to such variation because one can convincingly point out that a construction or a rectification argument, to which I'll come in a moment, would succeed. They may realise that the game is lost anyway on another basis. On construction application to the court, where the court is asked to discern the meaning of unclear words in a will, Marlene Rawlings explains that the court's job is to identify the meaning of those unclear words, and it must do that taking account of the natural meaning of the words, the overall purpose of the document, the other provisions of the document, the known and assumed facts, and slightly oddly, lastly, common sense. What the court mustn't do is take account of subjective evidence of the testator's intentions. However, Section 21 of the Administration of Justice Act allows extrinsic evidence to be admitted before the court to assist with construction where the will is meaningless, or any part of it is meaningless or ambiguous. And again, the will file may help with that extrinsic evidence in those circumstances. On a rectification application, I suggest you try variation or construction first, but if you're left with nothing else, rectification might assist. And rectification is allowed by Section 20 of the Administration of Justice Act 1982. And in circumstances where the will is so expressed that it fails to carry out the testator's intentions because of a clerical error, or because of a failure to understand the testator's instructions, the court may order rectification to carry out testator's intentions. Usually you have 6 months from the date of the first grant of representation, although there's discretion to allow longer time. The best judicial summary of the effect of the case is on clerical error, and when I say that, it's the accolade of the Supreme Court in Marlene Rawlings, not me, is what Mr. Justice Blackburn said in Bell and Georgiou. The essence of the matter is that a clerical error occurs where someone who may be the testator himself, or his solicitor, or a clerk, or a typist, I don't know if anyone's got typists anymore, but we know what he means. Write something which you did not intend to insert, write something which you did not intend to insert, or omit something which you intended to insert. The remedy is only available if it can be established not only that the will fails to carry out the testator's instructions, but also what those instructions were. And the other limb of the admission, the ability of the court to rectify, is a failure to understand instructions. And that obviously requires that there is a third party drafter. That's never going to work where it's a homemade will made by the testator himself, because there's no person that, through the medium of whom there's misunderstanding. In all cases, the will file is going to be helpful. Again, negligence claims, try everything else first, in particular rectification, because if the evidence to enable rectification exists, that ought to solve the problem, and the claimant ought to mitigate his loss by doing that. There will be circumstances where that is not going to work, because, for example, the legacy in specific legacy, or the subject of specific legacy in question, has already been dissipated by someone who shouldn't have had it in the first place. And remember that the negligence claim, subject to the negligence claim, may be the claim over for the costs of the court of protection application, the construction summons, or the application for rectification. That may be the loss that suffered. Just going to say very quickly a couple of points about loss. The beneficiary may lose a legacy, may lose the chance to be an object of discretion in a trust, and may lose a share of residue. And that may be because they're lost directly, or because of the loss by reduction because of other litigation costs. But the loss to the estate is a different loss to the wife and James loss. The estate will be able to claim in the testator's shoes for losses to the estate caused by the will writer's negligence. The duty is to ensure that the whole death estate, not the estate after the cost of expensive litigation, is available to be distributed as intended. And the estate, or the residue beneficiary, or the two in combination, may together be able to claim for the costs of probate claims that would not have happened. But they can't both claim for the same loss. There can be no, or should be, no double recovery. And there's a further point I would make, which is that beneficiaries under an earlier will cannot be owed a duty by the negligent maker of a later will, because the whole point of that later will would be to not benefit them. And to the extent that their estate, the estate in which they share, is reduced, that's a claim really of the testators or the estates, as I've just described. But the beneficiaries may be able to join with the estate's executors in bringing a claim for that loss, or indemnify them against bringing the claim, or even possibly bring a derivative claim. And in some cases, the court has ensured that all those parties are joined to the negligence claim to ensure that everyone's bound and to avoid double recovery problems. You'll be glad to know that I'm going to stop there. I'm not going to talk this time about tax. But thank you very much for listening, and I'll hand back over to Emma.
So there's not really much more for me to say, so I just want to say thank you to everyone who's joined us this evening. A very, very big thank you to Catherine McGuell from Radcliffe Chambers for coming to speak with us, and thank you to our marketing team for helping us put this all together as always. So thank you, and good evening.